on today for a public hearing and possible work session. I think what we're going to do is we've got four bills with only one witness signed up. They are Senate Bill 57, Senate Bill 62, Senate Bill 63, and Senate Bill 65. So at this time, we will open a hearing on those four bills. And, Council, if you would...
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, these four bills come to you from BPSST. Senate Bill 57 allows the Department of Public Safety Standards and Training to establish fees and guidelines for use of its facilities, including its training academy. Senate Bill 62. For some reason, they didn't give me a... Okay, hold on. Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 62 authorizes the Department of Public Safety Standards and Training to provide grants to private entities for certain purposes. Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 63 allows the Department of Public Safety Standards and Training to deny application for training as well as deny or revoke the certification of any public safety instructor or public safety officer. Senate Bill 65, Madam Chair, members of the committee, allows the Department of Public Safety Standards and Training to impose civil and penalties on public safety agencies who employ uncertified telecommunications and emergency medical dispatchers and three other uncertified police officers, parole and probation officers, and uncertified corrections officers.
Thank you. And we have one witness signed up, the Honorable John Minnis from DPSST.
I'd like to the Deputy Director and the Chair of the Board up just so I can introduce you to them. And particularly the Deputy Director is my brain resource, just in case I start.
The more the merrier. And I am so grateful that you taught me so well how to ask hard questions of government witnesses.
Which is why, Madam Chair, I brought back up.
That was very wise of you.
Which, Madam Chair, we've got which bills that were... I've got public testimony to pass out to your committee.
Okay. The hearing is open on 57, 62, 63, and 65. So you can... It probably makes most sense to just start with 57 and work your way through.
All right. Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the Senate Judiciary Committee. It's a privilege for me to be here in this position now on the other side of the dais. Several years later, testifying on behalf of the Department of Public Safety Standards and Training. My name is John Lewis, and I am the Director of the Department. Seated to my right is Mr. Eric Gallitz, who's the Deputy Director of the agency. And then to his right is Chief Bob Tardif, who is Chief of the Newburgh Police Department, also the Board Chair, and also the President of the Oregon Executive Development Institute, which will be referenced at least in one of our bills. The first bill, Senate Bill 57, is a bill that envisions the agency's responsibility in the utilization of the new Oregon Public Safety Academy that's being constructed off of Almsville Highway. It's due to be completed. Ribbon cutting is designated at July 17th of 2006. That particular facility has about 213 acres of property, an emergency vehicle operations driving course, a large scenario village, scenario barn, and also mat rooms for defense tactics training and a large firearms training center, including a 50-meter and 225-meter firing ranges that are all designed to be tactical firing ranges, plus classroom facilities. The agency anticipates that in the future, other organizations may, in fact, want to use the facility. One of the things that we want to look at is the appropriateness of charging fees to organizations that may want to utilize it. We currently have a restriction in Oregon statutes that limits the agency's ability to charge fees only for specific purposes, which is why the bill exists today. In addition to that, the bill would also authorize the agency to charge fees for non-mandated training that would be offered by the agency. Currently, mandated training is covered through criminal fines and assessment revenue, and in some cases, federal monies. With our fire program, it comes through the fire insurance premium tax. Through private security, it comes through the privately supported fee-based program, and there was at one time some federal money that was available, but I don't believe we have any federal money in our program currently. And that's the essence of Senate Bill 57.
Thank you very much. Are there questions of the committee, from the committee? I actually had one question. That is, we've got some other bills up to expand the training requirements for other sectors besides police officers. This is not, this fee is not necessarily just for those type of operations, is it?
No, it's not. I think a way to jump in here if I happen to misspeak, but there are some areas of training that the agency currently is not engaged in. The new facility will allow us the opportunity to have venues that will enable us to have additional non-mandated training programs that we could invite even private sector or other outside agencies to come in and participate in that we currently don't offer. For instance, there's a fellow by the name of Dr. Larry Blum, who's a clinical psychologist in Los Angeles, does a lot of training around the country on officer-involved shootings and force under pressure and how agencies should be training police officers in those kind of environments. This person can come in, do a train-the-trainer seminar for as many individuals that we would like to be training his particular program. What we'd like to do is be able to offer that and have a fee that we could charge.
Okay, thank you. Other questions from the committee? Thank you.
Hi.
Did either of you want to speak on this, or are you just here for reinforcement? Okay, thank you. Why don't we move on to the next bill? Senate Bill 61.
61 or
60? Oh, I'm sorry, 62.
All right. Madam Chair, members of the Senate to Judiciary Committee, Senate Bill 62 would authorize the Department of Public Safety Standards and Training to provide grants to private entities for certain purposes. Those certain purposes that grants could be offered to would be for the purposes established in Chapter 181 of the Oregon Revised Statutes that basically designate what our agency is supposed to be training toward, which would be public safety related coursework. There's an organization specifically, and one of the reasons that Mr. Chartoff is here, Chief Chartoff is here, is to talk about the Oregon Executive Development Institute. The Oregon Executive Development Institute is a private entity that was pulled together initially through the Oregon chapter of the FBI Academy and former graduates of the FBI Academy to begin training executives in Oregon in a way that they currently don't have available to them in the state. The Department of Public Safety Standards and Training would like to participate with organizations like the Oregon Executive Development Institute and also the Oregon Chiefs of Police Association, Oregon State Sheriff's Association, who are likewise private entities, by utilizing a grant process wherein we may be able to allocate a certain amount of agency resources to that private entity so that they can facilitate training. The Oregon Executive Development Institute is an organization that I participate in, and shortly after becoming the director, and I'm a recent graduate of that program, we have another individual who trains on a fairly routine basis at the Oregon Executive Development Institute, whose name I am forgetting all of a sudden, Dr.
Gilmartin.
Excuse me. Dr. Kevin Gilmartin. Dr. Kelvin Gilmartin is an individual who wrote a book dealing with emotional survival for police officers and public safety workers. He's an individual whose training is highly valued, but as it currently works within the Department of Administrative Rules and how we can pay for particular individuals or particular venues for training, we are limited under the state contracting laws to $5,000 or less in terms of its total cost, and that is the aggregate over an infinite period of time. So as an example, if we pay Dr. Gilmartin's fee direct one time at $2,500, and when we pay a second year $2,500 on the third year, we would have to somehow go out, well, we would have to go out and do an RFP process and a public bidding process asking for individuals who might likewise give similar training. So what this is intended to do is actually participate with an organization by giving them the money so that they can design the program and utilize the venues that they see fit for the environment of the training. Another example would be Oregon Executive Development Institute. They currently use a facility called Manuka, which is I believe it's a Presbyterian site that's formerly owned, I believe, by Myron Franks, Julius Meyer, former governor of Oregon. which is a fairly remote site in the Columbia River Gorge that doesn't have real nice facilities. It's fairly isolated. And one of the purposes that the Oregon Executive Development Institute Board likes to use that facility for is because it is isolated, so that the persons who are at the training don't go off someplace else in the evening, but they actually participate in learning about other agencies and how other agencies run their programs. So this bill would simply allow us to do that without having to be encumbered by restrictions that prevent us from utilizing the same venue more than twice or to an amount over $5,000 that, again, is an infinite, over an infinite period of time. It's basically been a restriction to the agency's participation with these private organizations. The Oregon Chiefs of Police Association likewise holds an executive management training seminar, usually at Seaside. And the agency, again, likes to participate with these organizations to further facilitate executive development training. So with that, if now share with your permission, I'd like to ask the chief to kind of join in and chime in and see if he has any comments and support.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, yes, actually the Oregon Executive Development Institute was created, I think, something like 15 years ago in a partnership between the FBI.
Would you identify
yourself,
please? Thank you.
My name is Bob Tardif, and I'm the president of the Oregon Executive Development Institute. The institute was formed through partnership approximately 15 years ago with the FBI, the Oregon Chiefs Association, the Oregon State Police, and DPSST at that time, and has been ongoing through the years. We formed it so we could provide training that's similar to the training offered to large police departments back at Quantico, Virginia, at the FBI National Academy. It's designed to prepare our police chiefs and sheriffs, and the newer police chiefs and sheriffs, and their number two people for leadership in Oregon law enforcement. We bring instructors from the FBI Academy here, in addition to the ones the director mentioned, and we keep the price down by donations from the Oregon Chiefs Association, sheriffs, and the Oregon State Police have provided in-kind assistance in the form of their training coordinator to help us, as has DPSST over the years. So we're able to offer this to small police departments and sheriff's offices at a reasonable cost to where they can take advantage of it. So it is a really important program. There are not a lot of executive training programs available here in Oregon, and the ability to continue this type of training does require us to depend on DPSST for the type of dollars that we can count on year after year.
Thank you very much. Are there questions or comments from the committee? Thank you very much. We'll move on to Senate Bill 63.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senate Bill 63, Madam Chair, members of the Senate Judiciary Committee, this bill addresses two problems. Currently, the board can only make a denial decision on matters that are discretionary disqualifiers when an certification, and this is after they've already completed the basic training and field training requirements of the basic training program. This means that an agency may make an employment decision, and DPSST has spent resources for training before it is known whether the applicant with the discretionary disqualifying event or conviction would be eligible for certification. Just as a matter of background, the agency spends roughly $12,500 of your money, CFAA money, to train each applicant and each person that ultimately graduates from the academy. And in addition to that, the agencies pay for the salaries and benefits of those individuals who are participating in the training program. So likewise, they have a significant investment in the officers as they're going through the training program. So the bill is really intended to try to go through a process that would determine whether or not a discretionary disqualifying conviction would prevent the person from being ultimately certified at the front end, so that we don't waste a lot of dollars. And that's the essence of the bill. I have a technical expert who does this full time for a living that might be able to expound on this if you have additional questions.
Okay, is that your...
No, actually, it's yet another one.
Okay. Obviously the concern would be not wanting it, having it narrowly enough drafted so that people who really are eligible wouldn't be caught into the net.
Well, that's correct, Madam Chair. If you recall, I believe it was in the 2001 session when I chaired this committee, the Department of Public Safety Standards and Training brought to the committee a bill that would have asked the Legislative Assembly to put in statutes particular qualifying and disqualifying convictions. The legislature at the time, and you participated in that discussion, was that we deferred the authority to the Board of Public Safety Standards and Training to develop a matrix to determine which convictions would be automatic disqualifiers and which would be discretionary disqualifiers subject to gaining additional information relevant to the applicant's qualifications and suitability for a law enforcement career. We did do that. The agency has complied in building that matrix, but this is one of the glitches that that appears in our current construct. In addition to that, the bill, I believe, addresses one section of the statute that deals with when a person may reapply for certification once they are decertified from the agency.
Okay. Thank you very much. Are there questions from the committee? Senator Whitson.
Madam Chair, Mr. Minnis, just a simple question on language. As I read line 5 of this Senate Bill 63, it says that you may deny the application for training, which sort of sounds like you prevent them from applying. I wonder if the term reject would be better than deny there, and that once they have that they've made their application and it doesn't fit your ramification, then you would reject that application.
Madam Chair, actually, Senator, that's an excellent question, and I don't know that I know the answer because I was actually engaged in a discussion yesterday relevant to the agency's authority over whether we can suspend a certification, and the word deny, which is currently represented in our statute, is a key to that because suspension is actually a subset of the definition of deny. If we change to the word reject, that may change that construct, but I'm not sure, because we're actually asking the Attorney General to give us some additional clarification with respect to the Board's authority. But I suppose it would certainly be within the purview of the committee to look at that word, and I think reject is clearly more representative of what we're doing. We're saying that this person, their application has been rejected. It would be tantamount to a denial or denial of certification. But it may have an effect on some of the case law that's been developed in our rejections or current administrative procedures hearings that have gone to the court. I'm not sure.
Thank you.
Certification. That's a very interesting point, Senator Witz, that the council points out that the deny is used to about the revocation of certification, but not the application itself. I think that might be worth asking a question of legislative council. Why don't we move on? Are there other questions from the committee? Why don't we move on to Senate Bill 65?
Madam Chair, Senate Bill 65 is a bill that would give the authority to the Department of Public Safety Standards and Training the authority to impose civil penalties to public safety agencies for violation of statutes that prohibiting employment of uncertified persons. I do want to make it perfectly clear that it's not the agency's intent to pursue public agencies that may have a technical glitch or a technical problem in terms of complying with certification, but is really intended to deal with entities that may, in fact, have knowledge and are refusing to or otherwise not certifying employees. In fact, the agency has probably one or two examples of an organization that when a person was revoked in terms of their certification, that the employer continued to employ that particular individual in their employment, notwithstanding the revocation that involved an emergency medical dispatcher working for a private entity that employs that person. Marilyn Morantz, who's here from Standards and Certification, told me just before the hearing that there was one other situation where a sheriff's department at one point, knowing full well that a person had been revoked, continued to employ a person or did not move towards getting the person certified, and that might be a potential instance. Many more instances within the agency where a particular department may not have a person who's fully in compliance with certification, but the agency's general modus operandi is to work with the agency to make sure that they are in compliance. There is also provision, I believe, on line 17, sub 5 of the bill that provides for a certain immunity to public entities that either terminate or reassign an individual who is not certified, and that particular immunity is based on the movement or termination of that individual solely on the fact that they are not certified or have been revoked by the agency, and is to provide at least some level of comfort to public entities that when they are attempting to, in good faith, comply with directives of the Board of Public Safety Standards and Training or revocations, that they're not subsequently found to be liable for having done so, and the agency, I assume, becomes the entity that is liable for making that call.
In line 11 of this bill, you have a blank space for the penalty. Do you have any thoughts on what should go in that blank space?
This is where I do what most agency directors do. They turn and look. Madam Chair, no, we don't. I don't know what the standard is within the states or the entities that do currently have this particular authority. I guess my initial thought is probably $5,000. It could be $2,500. I think that really is a decision that the committee can make. The other important point I do need to make is that these civil penalties, if they were assessed and eventually collected, would inure to the benefit of the state's general fund and not the agency itself. So it would be something that would at least give the agency the teeth and enforcement power that if an entity, public safety agency, refused to comply or did not comply, we could at least pursue some form of civil penalty that would hopefully gain their compliance, and hopefully the mere threat of that being in existence would be enough to cause them to comply.
Thank you very much. Are there other questions from the committee?
Madam Chair.
Senator Ringo.
Thank you very much. thanks for coming. Is it Director Minnis? What's the...
John is fine.
John. with regard to Section 2, Subsection 5 of the bill.
Yes, sir.
How does that subsection apply to the circumstance where you have an employee who's currently assigned to a law enforcement agency but maybe seeking advanced training? Does it apply in that context?
Actually, I don't believe that it... Go ahead.
Chair Burdick, Senator Ringo, right now the foundation for the mandatory certification at DPSST is at the basic level. So we look at that entry-level police officer, corrections officer, 911 operator, and that's the required certification to be in that profession. Within 90 days, they have to be at the academy. For a police officer, they have to be certified in the whole process within 18 months. This would be for those people that are outside of that timeline. It doesn't apply to advanced training. That would be
okay.
Furthering their basic.
All right. So if it doesn't apply to advanced training, that doesn't... I mean, if there's an issue with respect to somebody did or didn't receive appropriate advanced training, that's not going to impact the question of immunity for civil liability.
Madam Chair, Senator, I'm not sure I understand the question. If you could repeat it for me.
Well, I think that the gentleman on the right just answered it, but I was clarifying. This subsection 5 only applies to employees at the inception of their employment. I think you said for the first 18 months.
Madam Chair, Senator Ringo, under the current structure of what's required, that's correct. A new hired police officer has to come to the academy. They have to go through basic. Then that training is conducted further at the local agency. By that local agency, and then at the end of that cycle, no later than 18 months, they have to be certified as a police officer by DPSST.
Okay.
So this would be for somebody outside of that window. If that, and I guess, Madam Chair, Senator Ringo, perhaps a further discussion is, let's say that the officer is going to be a canine handler or a SWAT officer. That would be advanced training that they may be receiving at the same time, but that's different than that basic training that's required. They have to go through not only the academy in Monmouth, but also the field training manual, and that sometimes is done sooner than 18 months.
Would you identify yourself for the record?
Oh, I'm sorry. Eric Galvis, I'm the Deputy Director of DPSST.
Madam Chair, if I can, and perhaps counsel is about ready to go here, I hope, I'm praying. But if you look at the statutory references that are contained...
Why don't we let the counsel
hear? Oh, good. Yes, excellent.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Mr. Minnis, is this subsection 5, is this aimed at a situation as it relates to an employment situation where someone is being moved out because... they don't meet the qualifications and that would prevent them from going back and suing the agency for wrongful discharge or something?
Madam Chair and Counsel, I believe the statutes that are referenced, and I've pulled them and have copies of them, deal with the basic training certificates for the various areas, telecommunications, corrections, police officers and reserve officers. They're not the programs that are management level certifications or advanced or intermediate certifications, because anybody can work in these careers and have the basic level of certification. The only thing that as we're speaking about this issue is if, and what I don't know as the topic comes up, is if the board has the authority to impose these higher standards for instance, the chief of police. I know that there's a current discussion ongoing within the chiefs association and within the board of requiring that a chief of police working in the state of Oregon would have a management level certification. I don't believe this bill addresses that issue, and hence that would probably not come under the civil penalty provisions in this particular bill as it's written. My understanding is this is just the provisions related to the basic certification. So it would not be intermediate or advanced certifications or even supervisory certifications for that matter.
Okay. Thank you.
Forgive me if you covered this. I was distracted for a couple minutes. How many times would you say this has come up in your tenure where you would have actually used this authority?
The only there's only been one incident since I become the director of the agency in which this might even be contemplated. And as I referenced earlier, it happened to be a telecommunications worker, a 911 emergency medical dispatcher working for a private ambulance company who had been revoked by the agency, and there had been numerous conversations and notifications by our agency to the employer saying that this person cannot work in that capacity under the statutes, and they refused to comply and continue to employ the person notwithstanding.
Okay, thank you. Senator Whitsitt.
Chair Burdick, Director Menes, I wonder how some of these rules comport with very small communities. I'm thinking Sprague River, Adel, Plush. Is it possible that this bill and these bills could create a situation where a small community may not be able to afford certification and by that fact simply not be able to have some of the service? Is that a possibility?
Oh, Madam Chair and Senator, thank you for the question. It is current law that any person working in a police or any one of these careers has to be certified under existing law, regardless of this particular bill. So that problem exists today, and I would suggest that that is, in fact, a very real situation that occurs in some smaller communities, that it's very expensive to employ a person, send them to our academy for 10 to 16 weeks, because, as I mentioned earlier, the employer is paying for employees' wages and benefits in the academy, and in many instances, at least anecdotally, many of the smaller agencies suffer because they oftentimes will recruit. Their salaries are not necessarily commensurate with Willamette Valley salaries. Someone will be hired into a smaller agency, receive training, suddenly become certified, and hence they become marketable around the state and are laterally transferred into other agencies. So it's harder for many of these smaller agencies to recruit, and it's a continuing problem, notwithstanding what this bill would do. And I think, as I said earlier, it wouldn't be the intent of the agency to pursue civil penalties to the extent that it would cause that kind of financial harm. Most of our smaller agencies, we really don't have that kind of a problem with them.
Mm-hmm. Follow up,
please.
It always disturbs me when I hear the word it's not our intent to enforce this.
Yeah.
The courts say the letter of the law is the first thing that they look at, and if the letter of the law clearly says that you shall find them, then you shall find them. But your good intent may not protect our small communities' services.
Madam Chair and Senator Whitsitt, thank you again for the question. But there is, to some degree, and I'm not sure if this would assuage your concern, but there is some safety here in that the Board of Public Safety Standards and Training would have to approve the instances in which civil penalties might be used. And the Board of Public Safety Standards and Training is made up of individuals representing the Sheriff's Association, the Chiefs Association, and law enforcement, telecommunications professionals, corrections professionals from around the state, as well as other private citizens. So it isn't the department itself that would impose these. We would require the public review and approval of the board, and certainly if we were doing it inappropriately, I'm sure we would be back in this chamber or some other chamber likewise having to answer for perhaps the abuse of that power. So I do take those things very seriously, and as the director of this agency, my mantra is customer service, and we do try to work with agencies and try to help them get to where they need to be in compliance.
Thank you for the clarification.
Thank you, Senator.
Senator Pisanski.
Hi, John.
Senator, how are you, sir?
Doing well, thank you. I'm wondering, do you believe that on that line 12 of the bill, where it does have the word shall, that is necessary for you to be able to do your job? It would seem to me that if it was a may, it would give you the opportunity to use discretion where it might be appropriate instead of having a mandatory fine that I think Senator Wissett is concerned with.
Madam Chair and Senator, again, it is permissive, and when I discuss this is required by statute. All of our legislative proposals are required to be vetted through the board and through the executive committee of the board. Is for the department to come under the authority of the board and work with the board. So may is certainly fine with me, because our intent is to work under the authority of the board and at their direction. So I think may very well be a good substitute.
It may be.
It's permissive. Not mandatory.
Madam Chair, what 183.745 does, it sets forth the process and procedure for civil penalties. Except as otherwise provided by law, an agency may only impose a civil penalty as provided in this section. Civil penalty imposed in this section shall become due and payable 10 days. So it sets forth the process and procedure. So I think, Madam Chair, members of the committee, we would probably want the department to follow the procedure in there, so it would probably be a shall rather than a may. But at least as it relates to line 13, line 12 and 13.
I'd like to vet that a little bit, because I look at the lines, subsection 2 of section 2, 8 through 11, where it basically says the department shall recommend and then basically present it to the board for their approval of what this the schedule is going to be. And then it sets what the maximum is. I see number 3 is, then it basically is a mandate for the department to actually impose the fine that's required. It would seem to me that we're meeting the obligations under sub 2 of section 2 that's required by rule, but then, I don't see how the director is going to be able to use any discretion as to whether or not they impose the fine or not. If we have a scenario that says they're in violation, the way I read that, it says they shall impose that fine. And you just use the process that's within ORS 183.745. Now, maybe that section has more discretion in there for the director to make those determinations as to when they actually need to assess the penalty. But that's what I'm hearing, here at the dais, is the concern.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senator Pisanski, my gut tells me that was not the intent of Legislative Council's office when they drafted it. I think what they were trying to do, referencing this section, is saying, okay, if you're going to impose a civil penalty, this is the process and procedure you follow.
It could be.
I think, yes.
It could be. I see that.
It talks about the manner, yeah.
It could be. I guess for my comfort level, I'd like to just make sure that's when it actually would be interpreted, as compared to putting a mandate on the director to actually impose the fine.
It's like one of those pictures with the silhouette. You can look at it either way.
Right.
So probably does need to be cleared up. Council?
Madam Chair, too, there was a committee line 6, the Department of Public Safety Standards and Training may impose a civil penalty on a public safety. So for violations of, I've got them here in statute, certification as a police officer, et cetera. So they do have discretion.
Mm-hmm. Then what I would say is this, maybe to clarify for comfort for myself, and I think Senator Wissett on number 3 would say, if the department is going to impose a fine, it shall impose a civil penalty under this section.
Correct. Yeah.
That would
clear it up. Okay. Other questions from the committee? Thank you very much.
Madam Chair, just one other point that Ms. Lawrence raised is that we do currently have a waiver process also in our existing rules that in the event that an agency may be suffering from potential civil penalty that they could apply for a waiver, and it's been the practice of the agency to work with public safety agencies to grant those waivers where it's appropriate if they have a technical glitch or a reason why they can't come into compliance within the existing timelines.
Thank you very much.
Thank you,
Any
Madam
other
Chair.
Questions, comments from the committee? Thank you very much. We will close the hearing on Senate Bill 57, 62, 63, and 65. And we will open, before we open the hearing, Senator Walker and Senator Ringo, we're going to leave for a few minutes. Are you done with that, or?
I was just writing Senator Ring on it. I don't think we're going to be doing that. We're going to try to work this out.
All right, fine. I think we'll just continue to work our way through these bills then. We will open a public hearing on Senate Bill 61. Senator, excuse me, I almost made that mistake again. Director Minnis. Council, why don't you summarize the bill?
Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 61 modifies provisions relating to private security providers.
Minnis, why don't we start out with you again?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I do want to introduce the gentleman seated to my right. This is Harold Burke-Severs. He is the Policy Committee Chair for the Private Security Policy Committee of the Board. And Senate Bill 61 would modify provisions relating to the Private Security Providers Act, adding language that allows for maximum... Wait, what am I doing here? Hang on a second. You know what I'm going to do? This particular bill modifies the Private Security Act, and I'm going to refer to Harold, who is the expert in this area, who I think is prepared for some testimony, rather than just winging it, if you don't mind.
Thank you. Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you for this opportunity to appear here before you today. You should have before you now Harold Burke-Severs. I'm the chair of the Private Security Policy Committee. And again, I thank you for the opportunity to appear before you today. Back in 1995, ORS 181870 went to effect the Private Security Providers Act. And some of you have appeared here before you before. And you remember, as we go through this, every session we try and clarify and make this statute clearer so it can be more effectively used by our constituents. And so what we decided to do this year was several things. The governor has asked that we kind of clean up and make our rules and statutes more clear. And so we've gone through a process where we've streamlined some language and taken some things out of the statute and put it into administrative rule. For example, the training. And the reason for training, to just give you an example, we have many of our constituents that have outstanding training programs. And so whenever we want to implement an additional training program, we have to come back to the legislative body every 2 years and ask for a change in the statute. If we take those training provisions out and put them in the rule, that gives us greater flexibility to allow our constituents and the training programs that they have to be also become part of our training program throughout the state. For a good example of that would be our alarm monitors. Our alarm monitors have very specific training requirements that don't exactly meet the requirements that are in statute, but their training is recognized nationally by many of the alarm monitoring agencies. And so this will allow flexibility to allow greater training opportunities for our constituents. It also imposes a violation to give some of our public safety officers, police officers, some more authority when they come across an individual who is not certified under the current state statutes. Private Security Unit at DPSST receives regular communications from law enforcement agencies around the state when they come into contact with individuals who are not certified under the statute. And right now what happens is they call us and we begin a civil penalty process which takes months. And this will allow the police officers to issue a violation to those individuals who are not in compliance with current statute, very much like beauticians and barbers and folks like that, who are subject to similar violations for operating without certification and license. And with that, I would again thank you for this opportunity to appear here before you, and I'd like to answer any questions that you may have.
Thank you. Do we have questions from the committee? No. Senator Pisanski.
I know that there's going to be some individuals that will be testifying in opposition to at least parts of this. And I guess for clarity for myself, this would include anyone who does any type of security work within a retail operation, and I guess I'm wondering how that's defined, because what I've heard as a concern, and one that I would have concern, if you have a clerk, a sales clerk, who observes something happen, and they are going to actually either move to apprehend and or report it, would they be covered under SB 61 if implemented?
Yes, Chair Burdick, Senator Pisanski, thank you for the question. This definition, if you look under what primary responsibility is, says means an activity that is fundamental to and required and expected in the regular course of employment and is not merely incidental to that employment. So, for example, when this issue came up with the crowd management folks, if you remember, we worked through the same issue with them. You have someone who's taking tickets, and then the person crashes the gate. Now, that person may have to stop that person, which means they're taking enforcement action. That's incidental to their job. Their primary job is to take tickets. And this would be a similar case, Mr. Senator, where the person is a clerk, but they may have to take enforcement action. That's not their primary responsibility. Another example would be like a custodian whose primary job is to clean a school or a particular building. But they may also check the doors to make sure that they're locked. So they're doing, checking this for the safety of the premises. But that's incidental to their primary responsibility, which is to clean and maintain the building.
If I can follow up.
Follow up, please.
So then if you had an individual, I know some stores, such as Safeway, they actually contract their security services out to different security providers, at least some of the ones that go through my court that we prosecute, do that. Those people are, in fact, their primary job would be, and they would be covered by this. Then how about bouncers? In the sense that if you've got a nightclub and their job is to basically maintain control of that facility, maybe monitor for underage drinking or people coming into the premises that are underage. Right. That's one area I've heard some concern, and I know I have some concern that they're not being regulated or to some point based on some incidences that have occurred in my community.
Senator, Madam Chair and Senator, if you take a look at page 2 of the bill, line 32, and look at some of the definitions that are in the bill, I think you'll hear obviously from individuals who have some concern about how the bill is written and what its intent is and such. But it says private security services means the performance of at least one. And that's, I think, some people get off the reservation or get derailed when they look at least one of, and then you list, there's some new language here, observing or reporting unlawful activity, or preventing and detecting theft, misappropriation of goods, monies, et cetera, so on and so forth, or protecting individuals or property, which is where you may get your bouncers that you're speaking of. They may be. But I think you have to go back to the discussion and what Mr. Herbert Sievers testified to, and that is it something that is incidental, or is it a primary function, or is it something that is something you're primarily responsible for? And that's really the distinction. I think there's been some confusion based on at least anecdotally some of the concerns I've heard about it, that somehow this bill is going to take in everybody, including small mom and pops who are not currently subjected to it, and I don't believe that that's the case based on the way the Private Security Policy Committee has implemented its existing licensure and certification standards. And I believe that this bill is in fact a consolidation of or streamlining of two particular subsets of licensure now, I get the licensure certification thing a little bit mixed up with private security, in an effort to streamline and then move, similar to what we did with the criminal convictions matrix for other public safety workers, to the rule setting process. Then the other thing I want to add is that the legislature has set this private Security Policy Committee in statute and has made it part of the Department of Public Safety Standards and Training and the board for a very specific purpose, and that is to bring industry leaders and people who want to participate within their industry to vet these very issues. So notwithstanding some of the criticisms that I've heard, and you'll hear the testimony, I'm sure, in just a few minutes, I do want to say that that policy committee is, in my view, although this legislative assembly certainly has the privilege of making changes or adjusting those at will, that policy committee did, in fact, hear much of the concerns from the parties that you may be hearing from today. And, in fact, some of those persons representing those groups, in fact, participated with, and some of the language that is in the bill is, in fact, the product of their work. And I do find it and found out yesterday that there was opposition to the bill. But, again, we're here to work and make sure that both the legislature and the various industry participants are happy with the work product. And I did have an opportunity to speak with Mr. Sievers earlier before the committee, and he shares that same view. So we'd love to vet these things and make sure that we're not getting into areas that we have no intention of getting into.
In addition, Madam Chair, Senator Pozanski, I draw your attention to page 3 of the bill, line 28. Again, going back to our crowd management, it says a person performing crowd management or guest services. And I would argue that a bouncer, someone who's checking IDs at the door, making sure people are drunk, or alcohol monitoring, would be under guest services. And it says including but not limited to, again, we're addressing crowd management at the time, ticket takers, ushers. I would also put within that category under guest services, ID checkers, alcohol monitors, those kinds of folks. And so that's not the issue. The issue becomes because that person is not their primary responsibility to do security. They're there to make sure that the people that are 21 that come in, that a certain amount of drinks, you know, people aren't intoxicated when they leave and that kind of thing. And the question is, and they're not hired with the primary responsibility of taking enforcement action. So they are exempt under the statute. But how, and so if they take any enforcement action, it will be incidental to their employment, just like it would be for a ticket taker. However, if someone, but there needs, if enforcement action needs to be taken, like they need to put hands on somebody, like at the Copper Penny, for example, that person needs to be certified because there's training that takes place to make sure that the kinds of things that happen at the Copper Penny do not happen in any of these other types of establishments.
Madam Chair and members, just the only thing I'd add is, you know, the department and the policy committee certainly will be more than happy to work with the committee and the legislature to clarify language or make it more clear if for some reason it's not clear enough that that there is no intention to overextend the authority of this particular group into areas that are not places that we would be welcome.
Okay, well, why don't we, do we have more questions? Why don't we hear from the other side on this, and then we'll see if it might be productive to
thank you,
form a work group. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
We now have the other side, Gary Oxley, Julie Brandis, and Bill Perry.
Good afternoon, Madam Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, Gary Oxley, Oxley and Associates, appearing before you this afternoon on behalf of Fred Meyer Stores. I and my counterparts here are those that the director of DPSST referred to as off the reservation. And we're off the reservation because we do have some questions about the ambiguity of the way this is written and also some other issues in terms of primary responsibility. And we have talked with the director. And I believe that, let me say right at the outset, I believe they are willing to work with us on some of our issues and concerns. But let me, for a moment, address the committee that has presented this bill from DPSST, the Private Security and Policy Committee. I have a member of Fred Meyer who sits on that committee, as does Julie Brandis. And objections were made through that committee process about some of the things that appear in this bill. So, with all due respect to the chair of the Private Security Policy Committee, objections were made, and some of those objections do appear in the bill. Again, I think we can work all of these things out, but I want to go on the record as having an understanding of that. Stepping back for a minute, when the retail community was brought in to this piece of EPSST. The original intent was that companies could receive an FBI background check on an applicant who they were interviewing to be a loss prevention employee. And from that point forward, it would have been simply the responsibility of the company to determine whether they were going to hire that individual or not. In the past 10 years, there has been what I would call bureaucratic creep in terms of growing what the responsibilities of this particular entity within DPSST is doing. We've seen more complex rules. We've seen a training process put into effect. And so Senate Bill 61 now really does alarm us in terms of what it's entailing and where it's going. And again, to Senator Prasansky's questions, we believe there are some issues that need to be worked out and resolved. For example, in the bill, it specifically states that this would include, if you look at page 2, which was referenced earlier, starting at line 42, observing and reporting unlawful activity. Well, we believe that store clerks, a good portion of their job is to have a knowledge and idea of what is going on in that store. Specifically, convenience store clerks, who you have one clerk per shift, are trained substantially in observing the activities of what's going on in that store and preventing loss, picking up a telephone and making a call to the police department. Our clerks at Fred Meyer, and I would include Safeway in this, I know Albertsons does the same thing, those clerks are charged with the responsibility of ensuring that alcohol does not go out of that store either stolen or sold to someone who is under the age of 21. There are certain procedures that those clerks must follow, and if they fail to follow those one time, they are terminated. They don't get a second chance. There's no three strikes, you're out. Anyone who sells to a minor, who fails a sting or fails to follow company procedures on the sale of alcohol, whether it's selling to someone under the age of 21 or immediately reporting an attempted theft, are terminated. Pharmacists in our stores have an obligation and fiduciary responsibility under their license with the Board of Pharmacy to ensure that everything in the pharmacy box is locked up, is secured, is not allowed out of that pharmacy without a prescription. They are audited by the Board of Pharmacy on an ongoing basis and have to submit every 30 days an inventory control sheet to the Board of Pharmacy. That is a major fiduciary responsibility that they have to maintain their license, and also we would be responsible in a brick-and-mortar concept for a failure of them to do that. They are fined and the store is fined. So we believe that there are people in our industry, clerks, store greeters, Costco as an example, and representing Fred Meyer, let me tell you, I don't go to Costco, but I've been told that the greeters at Costco are there for one purpose. They serve as security people at the door. There is a relationship established when a customer comes through that door and makes eye contact with one of those greeters. They're there to try to immediately establish a bond between the customer and the store. And they believe that that does have a significant impact on security in terms of shoplifting and theft. Those people are there primarily for that responsibility. Also, I would point out that our clerks are in a MEPWatch program. It's a voluntary program that Safeway, Fred Meyer, and other stores participate in, where clerks are charged with the responsibility of pointing out or of noting any suspicious activity related to the sale of pseudoephedrine or pseudoephedrine products. If people are coming in teams and buying the maximum they can buy, the 9 grams, the 3 packages, clerks are supposed to report that activity immediately, even to the extent of going out and jotting down a license number of an automobile if they can do that. So again, does Senate Bill 61 include those people as part of the responsibility of having to be trained? Also, any employee preventing or detecting theft or misappropriation of goods could include a chief financial officer. That's their major fiduciary responsibility to their corporate employer, is to ensure that the product, is to ensure that there is no misappropriation of funds. Additionally, any employee charged with protecting proprietary information and keeping it from harm could be the vice president of technology information or intellectual properties. So we do have questions pertaining to who really is involved in this issue, and I think they're legitimate and valid questions. Also, we would like to have a discussion with the department in terms of the entire training program. Today, DPSST's program includes an 8-hour, one-day program for certification. Our stores run a 1-week training program. The training program consists of in-classroom time, and following that 1 week, then the loss prevention person is assigned to a supervisor or another loss prevention person for in-time store activity before they're actually turned loose. We believe that our programs are designed specifically for independent companies. Every company has different standards, policies, and procedures as set forth by their legal departments. We believe our training programs are far more in-depth and far better. In some instances, we have companies who actually deprogram the security person after coming back from the DPSST, because some companies don't want individuals patting down a person who may or may not have done something in the store. They're very, very concerned about the legal liabilities that are implied or go along with having a security person on premise and doing the job that they do. It's more about loss prevention, protecting the store, ensuring that theft doesn't happen, that there's a secure environment for the consumer who's in the store shopping. So those are the things we would like to address with the department. We believe that one solution to this is doing what OLCC has done. OLCC requires training for the sale of alcohol to clerks. OLCC today certifies our training programs. We don't have to send someone to OLCC for training. We don't believe we should be sending people to Monmouth, Oregon for a one-day training course by DPSST, when in fact the department could certify our training program and allow us to train individually as we see fit, we being each of the companies that are involved in this. So I would ask Madam Chair and members of the committee that you consider allowing work group be put together. Let us sit down with the department and see if we can come to some agreement on Senate Bill 61.
Thank you very much. Well, after I get over my devastation that the greeters aren't actually thrilled to see me, they're here for another reason. Do we have questions from the committee?
Well, Madam Chair, on that point, I was thinking the greeters aren't there to make eye contact. They are there to make sure I've bought my Costco membership card, but, you know, be that as it may.
Ms. Brandis.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Julie Brandis with Associated Oregon Industries and the Oregon Retail Council. The retailers that I represent are non-grocery generally, and some of the largest retailers in the nation. I think one of the things that causes complex, I've been following this legislation since the 1995. It's been just about my Full Employment Act, as somebody mentioned yesterday when I was lobbying them on this. I think one thing to take into context is there's all sorts of security officers and loss prevention officers. And I think what we're primarily concerned about from our perspective is the loss prevention officers or associates within our stores. These people, their job description is to do a variety of things within the store. First thing they have to do is make sure that product that could be stolen, would be stolen, might be stolen, is somehow protected. So that's why sometimes shelf spacing, things like that, comes into critical play. That's why you've seen a lot of serial veteran be moved up towards the front of the stores or closer to the pharmacists, something to that effect, prior to the pharmacies, Board of Pharmacies temporary rules. We made the jokes last session in the same committee about all we had to do to protect baby formula within our stores. That's the first and primary responsibility of a loss prevention officer in our stores. It's also to provide safety for our customers. For example, they want to make sure your shelves aren't stocked too high, that things aren't going to tumble down when particularly small customers climb up and try and grab things off the top shelf. So those are some of the jobs that they do. And I think in respect to this bill, we are concerned about what primary responsibility means as relation to the new definitions. And I appreciate Senator Prozanski asking some of those clarifying questions, because I did meet with him yesterday and offer to him some of our concerns. But I think as far as loss prevention officers and the companies that I represent, they don't see much value, if any value at all, in the program that is provided in Monmouth. Because, as Mr. Oxley described, that we have to train our employees because we're at risk as the retailer. If we do something wrong, as far as it's regarded in as detaining a customer or watching a shoplifter or anything like that, we bear the responsibility of how we treat that customer or criminal, depending on how the definition is taken. So we also have a little bit of concern about tossing all of this over to rule. And I think because this legislation has been reviewed for the last 10 years, every session, there hasn't been a session where I haven't been dealing with a bill, but I'm a little concerned, even though the rules do provide flexibility for change, rules are also very tough to, in very direct fashion, very tough to lobby. Because a lot of times you don't have as much opportunity to do viewpoints as you do in the legislature. That's just my personal opinion as a lobbyist. So I do have some concerns about that. The other thing I think about this legislation and how it applies to loss prevention officers is it really only applies to the big guys, the big retailers. The retailers who are often the target of litigation if you do something wrong. So if you're a small retailer, and I think about a gift store that I frequent in the small community where I live, the gift store doesn't have a loss prevention officer. It doesn't have anybody whose primary responsibility is watching out for shoplifters. But that person, the store manager on site that day, the pharmacist on site that day, he or she will detain somebody if he or she catches a shoplifter. But they don't have to do the training because it's, not primary responsibility. I'm not articulating or trying to articulate that they too should have this training. I'm trying to express that there's kind of this broad area of people we are regulating and then this very small area of people we are not regulating who are also doing the very same jobs, which I think the solution is to take a look at having the department approve our training program and take us out of, having to be necessarily certified individually by them. So I hope that clarifies some of our concerns.
Thank you. Questions? Now we get to hear about the bouncers.
Yes.
Mr. Perry.
Thank you, Chair Burdick, and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Bill Perry. I'm with the Oregon Restaurant Association. And ours is kind of a more specific concern. Just as you look at page 2, line 33 through 41, it was often easy as I had some of my members call up and say, do I need to be certified? I could always say in the past, if you don't carry a weapon, if you don't have a uniform, and you don't detain anybody, then you're exempt. That's kind of an easy standard. And I would like to kind of separate them out because I do think that Senator Porzanski's question earlier and I think what Mr. Sievers said is in the copper penny. A lot of these bigger establishments, they have security on the back of their shirt. And when you look at Division II, it still requires, if you're going to have security or any other statement that makes the general public feel like you are some sort of a security official, you have to be certified. And so I don't know specifically with the copper penny, but I do know some of these bigger nightclubs want that on their shirt because they want to send that projection. But a vast majority of my members that are going to be included that weren't included before are the people that are in either the high traffic areas, much like Northwest 23rd or the Pearl District in Portland, but also in the communities that have colleges, Corvallis, Eugene, and some of the others. And what these people do is they just generally have somebody outside sitting on a stool that checks IDs and will walk around the building to make sure that people aren't doing drugs or other things. And if they see somebody, they'll just go call the police. They're not supposed to confront them or anything else. They want these people to disperse. Now, previously I was exempt, and I think previously I would have fallen under K, which Mr. Sievers also referenced on page 3. But clearly, when you look at the new language, I'm observing, which is one of the qualifications, and number 2, I am controlling access. And this is probably 90% of the people that are not being certified today that would be included, and a lot of these are short-term employees. A lot of times it's a tavern that doesn't usually need a doorman, but all of a sudden it gets busy on a Saturday night, so they send one of their bartenders out just to try to do more crowd control or easier to check IDs at the point of entry. So I would say it is a pretty drastic change. And if there are issues with people using physical force, I think that's why when we agreed upon the, you know, if you have somebody that's detaining a person, if there's physical force issues out there that are not being addressed and need to be addressed, I have no problems with that. But, you know, walking the perimeters in neighborhoods and checking ID is going to be a pretty expansive portion of this bill that we haven't had in the past. And so I think there is a drastic policy change just from those two specific. I like the previous ones that are 33 through 38. I think that achieves most of the problems. If we need to do a few tweakings, my preference would be find inside of the where these people are not being trained today and how we get them trained. But I think by adding the observing and the controlling access, you're expanding this quite a bit. So with that, I'd be more than happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Do we have questions from the committee?
I do have a couple, but go
okay,
ahead.
Okay, you go ahead.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Mr. Perry, I appreciate your comments, especially regarding not having any problem with those individuals that use physical force to control somebody. They should be regulated. I'll be very frank with you. I've got two establishments in Eugene that have been out of control at different parts of their tenure. One of them, I'm going to actually get the police to either come up here and give testimony or get the reports. But one of these facilities, it's almost like we have more calls after that area by our police officers going there to take care of stuff, and they've come across situations where there have been employees who have just beat the hell out of people before the cops can even get there. And I'm really concerned about that type of image and what that does. I mean, of course, the owner of those facilities, I think, are very, very much on the line for civil suits and stuff like that. But when I have officers coming to me saying they think that people are taking going, let's say, beyond what's reasonable in controlling someone, it seems to me that we as a state have some obligation to try to rein that in. And maybe it's through the liquor licensing, taking away their license. I don't know. But it seems to me that there are some cases in college towns where you get some individuals that are raging hormones, whatever it is, and they decide to act out. And they use their, anyway. Mm-hmm. And so those are the things I'm concerned with. At the same time, I don't want to see the clerk who's checking out somebody or someone that's working at the cashier that takes some step to keep something from occurring to be caught up in this. Mm-hmm. So I think there should be some, hopefully, additional work on this to actually get something that we hopefully all can agree to and make certain that we're not setting up situations that we have people visiting our communities and all of a sudden find out that they're in the middle of a brawl and on the losing end because they're outnumbered by people are just exercising their strength.
Thank you for those comments. Are you through?
Madam Chair.
Senator Ringo?
Those aren't ducks beating up beaver fans, are they?
Senator Ringo, ducks are very passive creatures.
Okay, thank you.
Let's hope so next November.
Council, do you have a Senator Winter?
Chair Burdick, Mr. Perry. I was in a big R store here this summer, and the door scanner went off, and three of the cashiers, all three of them, left the store in a hurry, and they came back about 10 minutes later with a young man in custody that had about $200 worth of stolen merchandise on his person. I don't see where that's wrong. Can you explain to me how that's wrong?
So let's say that, Chair, I don't do, our guys usually don't have theft issues, so I'm not, anytime you detain somebody, obviously, I think some training is needed, and I think their argument is they do training, so I don't have any problems with that. It's just a majority of my people, I don't want them to confront. And especially once they leave the store, because like I said, mine aren't theft issues. Majority of my members, if you've got a problem, you just want them out of the establishment. You don't want them detained. You don't want them kept. I just want my people off the premise. So from a retail theft issue, that really doesn't exist. And a lot of mine is once they leave the establishment, it's good riddance, let them go, and I don't ever want to see them again. So I think it's two different kind of distinctions. And once again, I do think that we did agree if you're going to detain somebody, I understand training aspects of it, you know, but we don't, I would say most of my members don't want to detain anybody. They just want them gone. So that's probably a better question for the other panelists, not me.
Ms. Brandis, would you like to respond to that?
Sure, I'll start and I'll let
Mr. Let's keep this quick, too, because we do need to move on.
The Madam Chair, Senator Whitsett, the stores are all very different in how they handle your electronic device deterrent tools. In many of the stores that I represent, two employees have to actually witness the person leaving the premises without having paid for goods for any type of detainment to occur. And that is primarily, again, to protect the reputation of the retailer. But each store has a different philosophy, I can tell you, because I represent a lot of big stores, different philosophy on how they approach those. So anyway, and if there is a detention going on under current law, they have to be licensed. If that's part of their primary responsibility. And we wouldn't send anyone into a parking lot in the stores that I represent if they haven't been trained to do loss prevention.
If you have other questions? Okay, I would like to have the parties get together. It sounds like there is a possibility for some compromises and some discussion on this bill, so to form a work group with Director Minnis. Did you want to speak some more, Director Minnis? Director Minnis would like a parting shot before we go, but I would like to I would like to form a work group and I'll let him just give a couple of very brief comments and have a little more direction.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I do appreciate the courtesy of coming up and doing some rebuttal, if you will. I just want to say to the committee, it's very important. I think the committee members have raised some very important points. You really can't have it both ways. You can't have a good training and not have certification and, you know, have the Private Security Policy Committee somehow involved in this. So I want to remind you that the work product that you see before you is, in fact, the work product of the Private Policy Committee. Many of the instances that were alluded to here just simply are not accurate. We are willing to work with them, but I do want to at least point out one thing. The direction that this is going in terms of the work group with the agency accrediting, as I heard the testimony, the training of private sector training programs for their workers, and frankly, is fine with us. We don't have a problem doing that. In fact, in our police and correction side, we have statutory authority to do accreditation of training programs for private sector groups, university systems, so on and so forth. We do not have that authority in statute as it relates to private entities for private security purposes. And hence, if we did get that authority granted in a bill, there would be a subsequent cost associated with the accreditation of these programs in that there would be a cost at reviewing the programs. And likewise, we share some of the comments with respect to the amount of training. The 8 hours referred to is statutory language. We are limited by statute to 8 hours training. The bill that's before you literally would allow by rule the policy committee to expand that training and expand the scope of the training. And perhaps there's some fear of what that expansion might look like. And so it's the agency's intent to try to provide as much relevant training that's high quality to these individuals as possible. But the extent we go to an accreditation process, I, as an agency director, do not have the staffing to do the accreditation. That would be part of what would have to come back, and I do fear that that would be a subsequent referral of Ways and Means to get that funded, in that it's not part of what was anticipated in the governor's recommended budget and is not currently part of our budget. My discussions with the private industry folks was that if that is in fact the direction they would want to go, it would be their responsibility to go and lobby that issue, I think, with the governor's office, because I think the governor needs to be involved in that decision-making process with respect to amendments to his recommended budget.
Well, but if they're wanting accreditation and it was a substitute for the 8-hour training that they have to pay for, it would seem to me that something could be worked out to where that could be structured so that they could pay for the service.
Madam Chair, absolutely. I guess what I'm saying is that there would be a cost that would require, I believe, at least a position or a half-time position to look at these programs.
I'd like the work group to consider that, including have it be self-supporting, because we really, in today's world, we don't have the option. And I'd also, and I know that you will be very receptive to this, if they indeed have circumstances where they're having to deprogram people from training. I know that would not suit you well, and I would hope that would be part of the discussion.
Madam Chair, far be it from me to speak for the legal counsel of any private company, but there are significant issues in any situation where you're taking physical custody of any person. And so I'll let them stand in their own stead for how they want to defend themselves in taking that. We would advocate for more accurate and very high-quality training for these persons.
Go ahead and if you would all be willing to participate in a work group, and don't be afraid to be creative.
Madam Chair, when would you like us to respond or come back with some work product or answer back?
Probably within 3 or 4 weeks. Would that be agreeable?
Absolutely. Got to do it probably sooner than that.
Senator Pazansky wants it even sooner than that.
Knowing the process, I just think that if we wait a month for us to do something here and try to get anything over, it may not happen.
Right. Madam Chair, again, and certainly we'll be willing to facilitate that and do it as quickly as we possibly can. The participants of the work group would be?
The three parties who were here, and you, and the commission.
The private policy committee.
Correct.
Thank you.
Okay, that would
great.
Be great.
And appreciate the opportunity to be here.
Thank you. It's good to have you. We will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 61. And we're going to move to a very brief work session on two of the bills we just considered, Senate Bill 57 and Senate Bill 62. Unless I see serious heartburn on the part of committee members, I'd like to go ahead and move those out. So we will open a work session on Senate Bill 57.
Madam Chair.
Senator Starr.
I move Senate Bill 57 to the floor for due pass recommendation.
Senator Starr has moved Senate Bill 57 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? So ordered. Close the work session on Senate Bill 57 and open a work session on Senate Bill 62. Senator Starr.
To the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Senator Starr has moved Senate Bill 62 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. I will carry those bills. Now we will move to a different subject area, court reporters, and we will open a hearing. We will open a public hearing on Senate Bill 330 and Senate Bill 331. Counsel.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, House Senate Bill 330 allows a reporter employed by a party to court proceedings to charge a fee as agreed to by the parties, continues the 250 cap per page that the reporter may charge for a public body. Madam Chair, Senate Bill 331, which I mislabeled as 330, clarifies that a stenographic reporting of a court proceeding is the official record of the proceedings if all parties of proceedings agree to the stenographic reporting. As Chair, members of the committee, these bills come to you from a work group that was joint interim judiciary committee work group during the interim that was headed up by Senator Walker.
Okay. Senator Walker, I'm glad you're here for the discussion. Let's see. Are all three of these on the work group?
Madam Chair, all of those organizations are represented. Laura Smith was involved, as was, I believe, Scott Crampton. Alex Dunn he was not. But I think his organization, the Oregon Travelers Association.
Okay, why don't we start off with Laura Smith, Doug Friend, and Scott Crampton.
Madam Chair, I think there's one other member here from the organization.
Catherine,
we have Catherine Sheets here with us.
Yeah. Just go ahead and drag another chair up there if you need it.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Laura Smith with Dave Barrows and Associates. I'm here today representing the Oregon Court Reporters Association. We asked Senator Burdick and Senator Walker to put together this work group at the end of last session to kind of talk about where we are with the status of the transcript. As you all know, there's been deep cuts in the judicial department's budget, and as a result, official court reporters, that is, court reporters employed by circuit courts, have been cut drastically. There are very few court reporters reporters left, official court reporters left in the state right now. That means that most of the proceedings done in circuit court right now, and most of the courts in Oregon, are recorded by mechanical means. This has resulted in many inadequate transcripts due to either inaudibles when people cough or a train goes by or something like that. They end up missing whole sentences in proceedings. Many times these proceedings are on a CD or a tape, and an untrained transcriptionist will come in and transcribe the record, and they have no knowledge of legal language. In one case, a transcriptionist transcribed habeas corpus as baby porpoise. Or just sometimes basic human error happens where a court clerk forgets to turn on the machine, so you're missing either hours and sometimes whole days of testimony. So this is producing very inadequate records. But those we have before you today are some simple changes that we brought forward that we think make a bad situation a little bit better. It enables parties to have access to a high quality transcript provided by a live court reporter. And at this point, I'll turn it over to my colleagues here, and they're going to tell you a little bit about the details on the bill.
Thank you very much. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Doug Friend, and I am a past president of the Oregon Court Reporters Association. I'm currently on the board of directors of the National Court Reporters Association, and I also am a firm owner of a court reporting firm in Portland. I would like to speak to you briefly on Senate Bill 330, if I could. As Laura said, due to the budget cuts, the majority of courtrooms in our state now are simply recorded. They are not reported. There have been many documented cases of recording equipment failures, including right here in Salem, the Northwest Steelheaders case, which was a multi-day civil trial, which ended up having to be completely retried at tremendous expense to the litigants and to the state. In Multnomah County, there was a murder trial where all of the eyewitness testimony was missing. And a particularly grievous case is in Clackamas County, the state of Oregon versus Ayala Gomez, where it had to do with the rape and murder of a toddler, and there was no transcript for appeal. These problems and others have prompted many attorneys, in the vast majority of cases, civil litigation attorneys, to hire court reporters to come in and report trials at their own costs. There is no cost burden to the state in this case. And they want court reporters there to capture the record for immediate or later transcription, or they will also hire court reporters to transcribe the CDs from court in order to try to make the best transcript possible from the proceedings that there are there. Today's statutes, which were passed with the idea that the makers of transcripts would be state employees, set the fees, as Mr. Taylor said, at $2.50 a page. These rates were put into effect 15 years ago, so they are old rates no matter. We have brought forward for everybody's comfort level the -1 amendments, which state that the transcripts will continue, no matter what, to be prepared in conformance with the rules of the Supreme Court. And we want everybody to know that we are 100% willing to abide by that. The Oregon Court Reporters Association strongly believes that the change in circumstances requires that the principles of a free market economy be allowed to prevail, as happens in other aspects of our work. I'd like to state that as the owner of a court reporting firm, the rates that are set in statute right now do not allow me to pay a professional court reporter what they should be receiving, what the going rate is in the marketplace for what a court reporter would receive for preparing a transcript. Again, that's because these rates were set with the idea that the people sitting there taking down the testimony would be state employees. The state would be paying them a salary, taking care of all of their benefits, that idea. Unfortunately, that is not the reality today. With the support of the Oregon State Bar, the Association of District Attorneys, the Oregon Trial Lawyers Association, Public Defense Services, The Oregon Court Reporters Association would urge that you support SB 330, and I thank you.
Thank you. Just worded a little awkwardly. This basically says that if they're a state employee, they still have to charge $250 a page.
That's
but
accurate.
If they're not a state employee, then that's negotiated.
Absolutely.
All right. Are there questions for the committee? Senator Walker.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I want to thank you for charging me with working with the parties on the work group. And Mr. Friend made a good point that I want to illustrate, is that if you're a state employee, they're providing you with a workspace. They're providing you with your supplies, your court reporting steno pads, and all of those things. But when you are a freelancer, you get none of those things. You pay for those yourself, as I do currently, and therefore your costs are higher. And $250 a page is not market rate at all. In fact, in federal bankruptcy court, I'm allowed, and the fee is set by judicial conference, it's $330 a page for an original. And it's 83 cents, which is a very strange number for the copy. But, that's a significant step up from $250, and it recognizes that we are independent contractors and we are not getting paid or given any benefit. So I think what they're asking here is quite reasonable.
Madam Chair, can I just make one clarification? When Mr. Friend listed off the people who are in support of this bill, they're supporting the concept of the bill. A couple of people had some small minor changes that they just wanted clarifications on, and I assured them that we would take care of those with some amendments that would come forward. So I just want to clarify that.
I appreciate you saying that. Thank you. Other comments or questions? Thank you. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Catherine Teach Schnitz. I'm the president of the Oregon Court Reporters Association. And the Oregon Court Reporters Association strongly supports Senate Bill 331, which guarantees that when parties agree to bring a freelance court reporter into the courtroom, that they will be allowed to be the official record for all proceedings, including the appeal transcript. This bill would accomplish to allow the parties to decide who prepares the official record. They would have access to state-of-the-art technology, and when a court reporter is designated to prepare the official transcript, they can be assured it will be prepared by a professional. And as Ms. Smith talked about, right now most of the courtrooms in Oregon are recorded by digital or audio recording. And at this point, if a court reporter if parties want to have a court reporter come in and be the official record, the court staff still has the ability to restrain the court reporter from performing that task. And so sometimes the litigants hire the court reporter to come in to record the testimony. The attorneys will ask that transcript be done, but when it comes time for the appeal, the litigants are then having to ask the recording to be the official transcript and having to pay for that twice. State-of-the-art technology, at this point, court reporters can provide real-time testimony. They can set up their laptop and provide instantaneous feed to the litigants so they can see the proceedings on their laptop as it happens. They can provide rough draft at the end of the day. They can provide daily copy so that they have an official transcript to use the next day. With electronic recording, this is not possible. Only stenographic reporters can provide this type of litigation tool. And also, when the transcript is prepared by an official reporter, it is done by a professional, and you won't have the inaudibles and the blank missing tapes that happens with the electronic recording. And at this time, in Multnomah County, there are provisions where the parties to litigation can come in, and they have an order which all the parties sign, and it requires their minimum requirements, standard requirements for the court reporter, so that they know that court reporter has those requirements before they come in, and the court reporter is the official record. The stenographic reporters leave their notes in different formats. They can leave them in steno notes or on a disc so that the state does have property of those stenographic notes. And I Thank you very much, and I'm happy to answer any of the questions you may like. Thank you very much.
You know, I've watched Senator Walker over here with her little machine as she's practicing for to get back to work after the session, and I'm just amazed at how much quick thinking and cognitive—I don't know what it is—but I know I couldn't do it. Which makes me ask you: what are the professional requirements for what is? You know, how do you determine who actually knows what they're doing on court reporting and to make sure that you have the quality that you need for these transcripts?
At this time, we do not have a mandatory CSR in this state. We would like to, but the funds don't allow us to do that. But we do have a voluntary CSR.
A CSR is
a certified shorthand reporter program through the state court administrator. It is a voluntary program, but the majority of court reporters in Oregon either have their CSR designation or they have what's called an RPR report, registered professional reporter through the national organization, which Mr. Friend mentioned that he's a board member. And those minimum requirements are 225 words per minute, question and answer, and then jury charge at 200 and 180 literary. And so, and that is actually what is required in Multnomah County at this time as a pro tem stenographic reporter, that the minimum standard would be that you have your CSR, certified shorthand reporter requirement.
So when if this, I think it's 331, if that one passed and the that transcript was required to be the public record, do the lawyers who voluntarily hire such a reporter, do they look at these requirements, or do they have to look at these requirements?
Madam Chair, it's my understanding that the Judicial Department is going to bring forward an amendment that would require any freelance reporter that came into a court to be a CSR, and our association would be happy to support that.
Good. I think that would be a constructive amendment.
Yeah, we'd be happy to do that. My understanding, the Judicial Department's bringing forward a few amendments, and it sounds like we're pretty much on the same page on most of them. I'd like to take a closer look before I say for sure, but it looks like we could support most everything.
Now, is that a shorthand page or a regular page?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, if I could just add the Oregon Court Reporters Association, our board of directors right now, is on a campaign to get out there and make the attorneys aware that we really want them to use people that are certified. So that is something that we're doing some articles for the Oregon State Bar and the Oregon Trial Lawyers Association publications and things like that. So we are getting the word out there that this is something that's very important for them to look for those designations when they ask for a court reporter, whether it's in court or in depositions.
Okay, great. Thank you very much. Are there other questions, Senator Pozanski?
Thank you. I assume the standards that are required for the type of reporting will be required by the judge, in the sense of you're talking about the Bill 331 talks about stenographic reporting. You talked about real-time reporting, where you have, I guess, the ability to actually have the voice transcribed into stenographic. Is that how that works, real-time?
The real-time is where the court reporter writes it on her machine, it's translated into text on her computer, and then it's fed to the attorneys. And that is not that's not a requirement of the CSR, but sometimes the attorneys do like to have that during trial. So they would have to specify that at the time they would hire a court reporter, that she have that capability, she or he have that capability.
But would the court have some authority to say if he or she is the judge wanted to have a certain type of recording done, or is this just going to be decided between the attorneys and then also the court is not stuck with, but they only get the type of reporting that the attorneys have agreed to?
Madam Chair, Senator Pozanski, I believe at this time in Multnomah County, the parties to the litigation agree that they want a court reporter, they have to go before the court, and then it is approved. So at that point, the judge would have the authority.
Okay.
And I believe that's, Madam Chair, Senator Pozanski. As far as this bill goes, it's the Judicial Department that is going to bring forward the amendment that requires the CSR. And as I said, I have not yet seen those yet, so I don't know if it has the real-time requirement in that or not.
Right.
once again, the association would support anything that came forward that had basic requirements, though. So,
could your, if you're going to require it to be a public record, the judge should have the authority over what kind of record it is. Council.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, when I was out in the hallway and came back, Mr. Linden approached me, and Mr. Linden was on the work group, and he said the work group did not endorse. I do not believe I stated the work group endorsed. I said I believe it came from the work group, but I would like to clarify for the record my intent was to say it came from the work group. I believe that's what I said, but I'd like to make that clear.
We'll stand by you, Mr. Council. Thank you. Are there other questions from the committee? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We have Scott Crampton, who also wanted to speak on this.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm Scott Crampton. I'm the Director of Appellate Court Services for the State Court Administrator's Office, and I served on the work group this past summer. I've provided some written testimony for you to review, and I won't, in the interest of time, repeat all of the points made by the previous speakers. Senate Bill 330 has no apparent fiscal impact on the Judicial Department, and we are neutral on the policy of the bill. We do have one concern about the potential impact on the cost of justice to litigants as the bill is drafted, and have proposed two amendments to address those concerns. Our concern is that the bill allows the transcript fee to be set only by the party employing the reporter. If another party in the case becomes the appellant on appeal who did not participate in that original discussions and negotiation on the fee rate, that party may have to pay a transcript fee that's far above the present statutory maximums. Our amendment would simply propose that all parties be required to agree to whatever transcript fee charged by the reporter employed by one of the parties was. Secondly, with respect to the timing of that agreement, the bill is silent on the timing of when the agreement must be made between the reporter and the party employing the reporter, and we would simply propose that agreement must take place between the parties and the reporter prior to the commencement of the proceeding to be reported. Other than that, we have no comments on the bill, and I'd be glad to answer any questions the committee may have.
Thank you. Are there questions from the committee, Senator Walker?
Well, Madam Chair, I just find it a little bit ironic that the Judicial Department's concerned about the cost of justice when we don't have court reporters in the courtroom. I think people find that they have transcripts that are inadequate and completely leave out testimony and forget to record testimony. I think that's a travesty of justice. So I just found it a little bit ironic that we're concerned about that, but I appreciate your comments.
Thank you. Are there other questions? Thank you very much. Our last witness, or next to last witness, is Alex Dunn from the Trial Lawyers, who wanted to address both bills. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you.
Let's go ahead. Okay. Madam of the Chair and members of the committee. My name is Alex Dunn, and I am a trial lawyer here in Salem. I'm here on behalf of the Oregon Trial Lawyers Association. I have a checklist here that I've made out that I was going to go through with you. However, it looks like many of my points have already been discussed by the prior testifier, so I will try to be brief here. First, I'll just start with Senate Bill 331. OTLA generally favors actually both 330 and 331. The main concern that we have with the court reporting services in the courtroom setting, the audio court reporting services in the court setting, is that there can be many errors. As we all know, oftentimes there's background noise, you can't make out what was said, people move around, and it oftentimes leads to unintelligible recordings. I don't really see any drawbacks with the bill, with 331, which would allow the litigants to actually fund the court reporting services. So I think that's probably enough on that. Simply stated, I think that if you allow the human reporters in there, there's going to be less of a chance that a litigant will be prejudiced on appeal. Second is Senate Bill 330. There's only one section of that bill that concerns the Oregon Trial Lawyers Association, and that's subsection 2, which I'll read here. It states that, except as provided in subsection 3 of the section, a reporter employed by one of the parties may charge fees as agreed to between the reporter and the party employing the reporter for preparing transcripts on appeals provided by ORS 8.350. The practical problem that may occur there that we see is where you have a court reporting service negotiating savings with a large litigation firm, for example, and then recouping those savings from the non-employing litigant or party. We think that that fairness would dictate that that should not be allowed. We would propose that there be an amendment that would safeguard against that situation, that would prohibit the transfer of any actual court reporting cost savings extended to an employing party to any non-employing party to the litigation.
If you could work with the proponents of this bill to draft and with our council to get something like that drafted.
I'm sorry.
Maybe you could work with our council and the proponents of the bill to get something drafted along those lines.
Sure.
Okay, great. Thank you. Is that it?
That's it.
Thank you. Questions? Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
We have Charlene Reese from the Oregon District Attorneys Association here who wanted to speak on Senate Bill 331. Welcome to the committee.
Good afternoon. Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Charlene Reese. I'm a Deputy District Attorney in Marion County. I'm here on behalf of the Oregon District Attorneys Association. Our position on Senate Bill 331 is essentially neutral. However, in reviewing this particular bill, we did realize one potential unintended consequence that we wanted to bring to your attention. Specifically in Lane County, it's my understanding after speaking to my colleagues that they have approximately 10 court reporters that the court services still provide to report their court proceedings. In Marion County, we're fortunate to have 3 to 4 court reporters that are provided by the courts. They report both murder-type cases. They also report ballot measure 11 and other felony crimes. Our primary concern is that if we open the door to providing our own, essentially what may happen as an unintended consequence is we may lose the remaining court-provided and funding stenographer reporting that we currently have in both Marion and Lane counties. And so I wanted to draw that to your attention.
Okay. Thank you very much. Senator Walker?
Well, yeah, Madam Chair, Ms. Reese, I really don't think that's going to happen because people don't want to hire their own court reporters and bring them in. That increases the cost of litigation substantially, and that's why this is so unfair that we don't have live court reporters across the state, because only the rich can afford to have a good system of justice and a good record. I just don't see that anyone's going to be bringing in their court reporter. They'd much rather have someone else provide that to them.
And that is our hope, Senator, is that it will continue to be a resource that's provided. Obviously, it's a valuable resource mm-hmm. to those of us who practice in Marion County. Like I said, it is a potential concern that if we are able to provide our own, essentially the court could dictate that their services are no longer needed. We hope that that doesn't determine to be the case, but again, a potential concern of ours.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. Follow-up. Simply, those counties have chosen what I think is a very smart decision to keep live court reporters, and they've made that choice, and they've gone to bat for their court reporters, and they really value having that service. And I applaud those counties for making those choices. The Chief Justice left it up to each county to decide how they were going to cut their budgets, and some counties chose to axe the court reporter. And, you know, I have to tell you, I've, of course, got a potential conflict of interest because I'm a court reporter, though I don't work in state court mm-hmm. and never plan to. I did early on in my career as a substitute, but I just don't like that courtroom scene. I prefer the federal court. But, you know, the point is that you still have that choice to cut your budgets and to have what you want as long as the Chief Justice says you do. So that, I think that's where you take up that issue.
Senator Krasanski.
Yeah, I think that's the point, is that what I'm hearing is the concern that maybe the Judicial Department says at this point, now that we allow for parties to bring them in, that they may say that that's where the cuts are going to come from, counties that have made that conscious decision to keep them. So I hear what you're saying, and it's one of those things that maybe what we have to be looking at, if we see the cost of doing these retrials on these more serious type of criminal cases, to make certain that those proceedings are in fact being recorded as they are today by a live person or something that's going to be perfect the record, so we don't have to retry the case and have the victims retestify and everything else.
Yeah, and the outcome in this particular case turned out different the second time, as I understand it. Counsel, did you have?
Sorry,
Senator Barr.
Thank you. I just got, I guess, a question on the wording, and I don't know if it's legitimate or not, but on Senate Bill 331, where you say where it says the trial court may use audio recording techniques, and then it goes to say that if all party proceedings agree, the stenographic reporting prepared by a party is officially recorded. Would this wording be an opportunity for one of the two, either the prosecuting attorney or the defense attorney, to say, wait, we don't like that court recorder, even if it's the employee of the state, and then that would prohibit that person from making the official recording of the proceedings, because it says both parties have to agree, and it doesn't say regularly uses anymore. It says may use our recording techniques. Just throwing out a question if that would be a possibility under this language.
Senator, could you direct me to the line that you're referring to?
Line 27 on page 1 of 331, where they're changing the wording from regular uses to may use in auto reporting techniques.
And that may be sufficient. We may not even head down this road where we lose the resources that are available to us currently.
But I understand. My point is not your concern, but the concern that under this language, if the state court is still providing a stenographer, so as you said they do in Marion County for certain cases, would the wording of this bill, if it passes, allow the defense attorney to say, I don't like that stenographer, I don't like that court reporter, I'm not going to agree to that person's recording being the official transcript of the, even though the person is provided by the state?
Yeah, counsel?
I'm chair of members of the committee. Senator Boyle, I think what you're seeing here, and we're seeing a lot of this in our drafts, and this is, I think, cleanup, because the current statute says, except in the 9th and 10th circuits, which is Baker, Malheur County, in any circuit court proceedings where the trial court regularly uses, and we're changing regularly uses, may use. And I think what it's more in keeping with their style of...
I understand that, but I guess the question is that, you know, under current law, if they don't regularly use the, if they regularly use audio reporting techniques, they probably can bring a court reporter in. But now this bill is saying that if both parties agree to the person they're bringing in, it can become the official record. But my question is, because would that open the door by changing that language and then saying that both parties have to, or all parties have to agree to that, that person being the official record? Could a defense attorney or a prosecuting attorney say, I don't want that court reporter in this courtroom, even though that person is an employee of the court?
I see what you're saying.
Madam Chair, just before 3 o'clock, I'll take a quick hit at this. I think what it means is the parties don't agree, then the official record is what the court normally uses.
Yes.
Yeah. I don't know. We're just about out of time here, but it'd be an interesting question whether people have actually questioned the integrity, basically, of the court reporter. I've not heard of cases like that, but Senator Walker probably might be able to shed some light on that.
I've not heard any either, Madam Chair. And I appreciate Senator Bias' question, but I believe it does resort back to what the court says we're going to use if the parties can't agree. And the court would not say we're not going to use our regular court reporter if there is one.
We have about 1 minute left where we can hear from Bill Linden, who has signed up.
Madam Chair, Senator Starr and I have to go. We have a committee, and I'm chair.
Well, I guess you have to go, Senator Walker. We will reconvene as a subcommittee to hear some things.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For your record, Bill Linden, representing the Circuit Court Judges Association. I want to preface my remarks by saying I have had a couple of conversations with Ms. Smith, and we are going to try and get together and see if we can work out some issues we have with this bill. The Circuit Court judges' essential problem with the changes being proposed in 331 are that they believe it intrudes on their authority to manage their courtroom. It is the court's record that's being produced. It's not the party's record. It's the court's record. The system right now, the judge, the trial court judge, decides what will be the type of reporting technique they use. We have 186 circuit judges. About 170 of them, I believe, are using audio or digital recording. This would put into the hands of the parties the authority the judge currently has to decide, this is how we're going to preserve the record. And I'm not sure we can reconcile the circuit judge's concerns with what they're trying to do in this bill here, but I wanted to get that on the record and indicate to you we'll continue to talk.
I appreciate that. I appreciate that. Thank you very much. We will, do you have a question, Senator Byrd?
Nope.
We will close the hearing on Senate Bill 330 and 331, and Senate Judiciary is adjourned. Thank you for staying the bitter end.
Yes, you can get to.
Yeah.